With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Harry from London, and you're listening to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything. My question is, if you could body swap with anyone for a week, who would it be and why? Okay, here comes the show, and remember, question everything.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dame Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer,
hello,
and a mix of very, very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked, and we are talking everything from...
We are talking everything from Harry from London's question. If you could body swap with anyone for a week, who would you body swap with and why? Dane, I think we maybe talked about this a bit a while back with James Acaster, actually, but have you got any thoughts on a week in someone else's body? Who'd you fancy?
Right now, I think I said this before, I'd be like Jeff Bezos and give it away. So give it away. Yeah. So I'd giving it away. Well, I'd give it away and I would put it into like various trusts for impoverished kids. So like you'd have like Syrian refugees, they'd be turning 18 and then £1 million kapow in their account. Everyone's like, how are these previously oppressed people now awash with fucking wealth? Why, Jeff Bezos? Why? And I'd be like, because fuck you, that's why. How about that? Yeah.
I'd just go with Cristiano Ronaldo, but I respect your decision. I respect your decision, Dave. But
Cristiano Ronaldo money, with Jeff Bezos money, you just clone your own Cristiano Ronaldo and you can body swap into that yourself, even when the spell is done, Howard. You've got to think these things through realistically.
I wasn't pushing that hard, mate. Sorry, but look, suffice to say, we ask and answer all the questions.
Absolutely, and thank you very much for that question, Harry. Great question. Keep them coming, guys, who listen to the podcast, and if you do enjoy the show, remember that no question is too big, small, or stupid. And if you like the show, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, you'll never miss an episode, or subscribe to us on Acast, the world's biggest podcast network, where you get to see all of our amazing and very special guests. With that being said, on today's show is a Franco-Irish journalist, filmmaker, and writer. Her documentary, City of Refuge, examined the plight of Syrian refugees in Lebanon and appeared on BBC Radio 4 and BBC World Service. Her Channel 4 documentary, The Truth About Muslim Marriage, was nominated for Best Investigative Documentary in 2018. In 2019, she started the We Need to Talk About Whiteness podcast, pioneered conversations about structural whiteness in the UK, and is also a former columnist at The New Statesman. Her writing is featured widely in the British press, including The Guardian, The Telegraph, CNN, and The Middle East Eye. Please welcome to the show, the magnifique Miriam Francois.
Hello, bonjour.
Hold, Howard.
bonjour.
I gotta do the last line. Welcome to the show, the magnifique Dr. Miriam Francois.
Oh yes, bonjour, much better. Yes, I did spend many years in higher education so that I could insist on people using the term doctor.
Do you force people to say it?
You know what? You don't force it, but I think if I were male, it would be standard. Whereas
exactly,
I'll be honest with you,
Beth,
as a female, I do have to consistently be like, yeah, so I'm on this panel because of the DR in front of my name. I do think that there are differences in people how you're treated according to gender when you have a DR.
You are the second DR we've had on the show, and both have been women. The first was Dr. Shirley Thompson, a wonderful composer and great kind of...
Dr. Shirley Thompson, OBE.
OBE as well. Shit, I'm getting these all wrong, Dave. Apologies.
That's also an important one.
Yeah, they do like that.
Yeah, we're very big on honorifics here. And so if we're going to present the flowers like we'd like to do, Howard, I want to make sure that the bouquet was arranged correctly. Because, you know, Dr. Francois, as well as having a Doctor of Philosophy, also has two masters.
Wow.
And that PhD is from Oxford, so we ain't playing the games out here, Howard.
You must have written a lot of essays, I imagine, Miriam.
I have read a good fair share of essays, but look, I'll be honest with you. I'm the only person in my family. I've got two brothers who has a degree, and I do have to put it out there that having a degree, particularly a degree from Oxbridge, doesn't make you any cleverer than your siblings. Otherwise, I will be pilloried at the next family reunion. I get it all the time anyway. Oh, you think you're smart. No, I really don't. I know that there's a lot of ways to learn things and books is just one of them. Okay.
Well, Doctor, you should try being a comedian and having people sit at a table when you're supposed to be the funniest person in the room and see how well that goes down.
Oh, that is quite the expectation. Yes, I could see that.
The expectation is that you'll always be bested. People literally come to dinner parties with their best material to have a conversation with you, not realizing all you want to do is go home.
That actually sounds like the opposite of comedy, although it could just be dark comedy. Well, there's definitely a sketch in there.
Oh, well, Doctor, as I'm sure you're aware, that most of the time, most people, we're living in a supposed civilized world where men no longer will do alpha displays of dominance in order to control a room or the leverage of power within a room. So,
oh, they will, but...
Well, not with other men, though. So most people aren't going to get into a scrap. But what they do is that normally humor is used by men who, I guess, wouldn't be perceived as alpha dominant. So they'll use jokes and wit instead of using aggressive displays of dominance, you know, in the same way that, like, you say, hello, I'm Dr. Francois, and then they go, here's a joke. Oh, you're a doctor, right? Where's your stethoscope? And you go, and your mum, the crack of your mum's ass. And then they go,
yes.
Oh, I'm going for a doctor, blah, 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 blah.
So, well, actually, my favourite one is usually people will go, oh, right, you're a PhD from Oxford. Did you know X, Y, and Z? Which I probably don't know, because guess what? I don't know everything. And then they turn around and go, oh, right, I would have expected someone like you to know about that. We can play that game if you want.
That's what I'm saying.
But nonsense.
You are going to lose, but sure.
Just continue with this line of thinking. I guess if you get sick, Dr. Dre can come and fix your fucking lungs then. What are you talking about?
Indeed. Although he would be a great person to call in an emergency, just not a medical one.
Well, yeah.
I think also I like to rate a lot of people by if I was sat next to them at a wedding for dinner, would I be able to fill the time? And I would with you, Miriam. Both of you, actually, Dane.
If we didn't know each other,
and it was like, oh, hey, tell me about yourself. You know, I've got you for like, what, best part of an hour and a half, 2 hours? Like, let's see if we can make this time pass, you know, without awkwardness. I think we'd be all right. I think you've got enough different things we can talk about based upon your background. So it might not be, you know, hilarious all the time. Potentially,
well, especially if you're sat next to Dane, but sure.
See, and that's exactly what I mean. This presumption, oh, Dane's sitting next to us, he'll be here for the jokes. What, because I didn't have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to drive for this damn wedding too. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it'll be all right. We could just talk. If I didn't know Dane, which is a weird thing to think about, and I sat next to him at a wedding, I'd just talk to him about the comedy shows I like. So that'd be all right.
To be fair, that would be all right. Can't really argue with that.
Sure, he'd enjoy that.
Whereas I've had times where it's been really not great. But anyway, we won't go into that now. It's probably time for a question, isn't it, Dane, as the format of this show dictates?
Absolutely. And as our very esteemed guest and long-awaited guest, Doctor, first of all, thank you for having me on your podcast first. So this has been a long time in the making, so thank you very much.
Oh yes, one good turn deserves another. No, thank you for coming on. It was a real pleasure. I mean, I as you introduced me, I do present a podcast called We Need to Talk About Whiteness for people who want to know more about the concepts. You can check it out, Spotify, iTunes.
Absolutely.
Subscribe.
Please subscribe. Some good stuff on there, guys. And it's definitely built on the conversations that we have on Question Everything in terms of the definition of whiteness or what that means ideologically as well as physically. So check out all of Dr. Miriam's work. But now, as our esteemed guest, we thank you for coming on the podcast. And we invite you to ask the first question, which can be any question you would like, which we will all discuss for about 15 minutes or some change. Then Harold will ask a question, which we'll also discuss, and then lather, rinse, repeat. I will ask a question, and then we all go off into the sunset on towards greatness. Does it sound like a plan to you, Dr. Francois?
It sounds like a fantastic plan. I have been thinking on my question for many years now, and I'm very delighted to bring it to a wider audience. My question is, what do you wish that you'd been told about life that you had to learn for yourself?
Can I ask what inspired that question?
Yes, there is a story behind that question, which is obviously that I have felt for many years now that I have reached a point that people regard me as an adult. This has been quite an interesting thought because I am still in consideration of myself as in the process of growth. But I know that as an adult, you're expected to know things like, you know, taxes and finance and medical questions, like what your NHS number is. And it just struck me over the last couple of years that no one really gave me the 101 on, you know, adulting and what that would actually entail. No one really particularly gives you the adulting on becoming a parent. So I'm a parent to my son, he's 7 years old. Yeah, no one, other women don't tell you the truth about what happens when you have a child, which is the immediate loss of all freedom. But yeah, I mean, there's just so many areas of life that I felt like that. Did anyone sit you down and say, you know, if one day you want to buy a house, this is what you'll need to do? Did anyone sit you down and say, you're going to have to put some money aside for a pension when you're older, start doing this? No, no one even told me how to do taxes. No one told me how to, you know, how money works. Did anyone explain how money works to any of you? Did we have a class in school that was like, this is how money works if you want to make, you know, good decisions?
No, I just had business studies where I got taught how to do a profit and loss account, which I've never used.
Glad you took that class then, huh?
It's a great, great question, hey, Dane. And I think it's one that I imagine you've got multiple answers.
It's a really good question. I will say, Dr. Francois, that I would theorise the reason why most people don't sit you down and explain these important and some of the more significant aspects of the human the human existence or modern life is because most people don't know themselves, and they really are just mucking their way through. And because they don't know themselves, what they tend to do by rationalizing it is either just plodding along and acquiescing to their what they believe to be their social and human obligations, or they project onto somebody else. And instead of someone actually sitting you down and advising you like you are their equal, they project their own ennui onto you and be like, don't do what I did, don't be a single mother, you know, it was hard for me. And they do it from a position of fear rather than actually having a structured conversation with somebody where they, you know, I basically believe, I agree with you. And the reason why people don't tell you this stuff is because, the psychiatry industry would be kind of bankrupt, number one, or the psychology industry would kind of be bankrupt, because a lot of the tools that we learn when we are recounting our life and the traumas that lead us to the positions we're in life come from the fact that, like, yeah, no one tells us this shit. So
I definitely, you know, I kind of really think this is a wonderful question. It's actually very interesting to hear you talk about a lot of kind of pragmatic stuff, Miriam, because in some sense, I think that is the most natural thing to approach, because you end up with a load of things as an adult that you don't want to have to do.
Exactly,
but you learn to do them, right? That's the very kind of fundamental basis. But I think the reality for me, and hey, we're all just individuals living our lives as best we can, eh? And try not to ruin everyone else's is my general thesis on life. I wish I had been told that when I became an adult, I would need to take the time to enjoy it.
That's a great point.
And I really have noticed that in lockdown this year, because it's a little bit like, I'm going to make a noise, listen. Like, I'm a little bit like that. And I'm like, you know, it's quite busy with my job. Podcast. I've got a 7-month-old child. Trying to keep the house together. Kind of keep friends and family sane in phone calls and stuff, you know, and also finish The Sopranos. And so you've got all these things going on in your life. And I just think that, you know, you're kind of always next. And actually, it's the most incredibly powerful thing when you can sit, as I sometimes do when I'm on the podcast, and I'm just listening to Dane or one of our guests talk, and just sit back and realise that you get to live a life that is pretty, pretty great.
Yeah, and compared to 90% of the world, you are living other people's dreams in so many ways. And we absolutely don't realize that day to day. And, you know, it is something that I think about a lot. I mean, I'm Muslim, and in our faith, the concept of gratitude is constantly reiterated, like it's something that you're meant to incorporate in every single aspect, almost every minute of your day. And like you in lockdown, that's something that I try and really focus in on so that I don't feel completely like I'm drowning in the uncertainty of the times, which can be super overwhelming. So I'm 100% with you that no one actually sits you down and says, if you keep just focusing on the summit, then you never get to enjoy the climb. And the climb is 99% of life.
Yeah, and having the kid, I mean, having the kid is a real good one for that, because, you know, anyone who listens to this show or that has a child or has had to look after a child knows that there's a period where the child is asleep and you tend to look forward to that.
Yes, you do. Very rare for a while.
Actually, I've had moments recently because he's started to crawl, listeners, and he's starting to kind of like develop into a human thing rather than just a blob. You kind of just have these magical moments where you just take a second, forget about the vomit and all of the stuff you've got to clear up and his bedding that needs to be changed and the bath that you've got to run and all the washing you have to do.
So imagine after all of that work you've both done, someone's going to turn around and go, it's my life, leave me alone.
No, that is a Western disease. That is a Western secular disease. I'm not having it in my household.
It's a human inclination in the same way that, like, you know, you are now an adult and responsible for somebody else. If I was to come and tell you, this is how I think you should raise your son, I'm very sure you would tell me what to do and it would not know where to go and you wouldn't give me a prescription. Because now you are an adult and you are a sentient being in control of your own faculties. You wouldn't want anyone else telling you. And it's just natural. And it's really about a large question where, you know, humans, we have a social obligation to humanity. It's why we have like religion and stuff, not just our own kids. And it's just crazy that like you create something, you are a part of something, that person has your genetic imprint or that has your DNA. But yet you really at some point will only be a guardian to that person rather than, you know, them being a possession, which I think is one of the things that I find a lot of people very hard to kind of digest as a concept, that, you know, you have ideas for what you want your child to be because essentially you are projecting another version of it, a better version of self, basically with a blank canvas that you want to mold in your image, because that's what happens when people tend to create something, particularly life.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, that creation has free will. And even though it might disappoint you, even though it might do things that are heinous, like, you know, you're still supposed to love your creation at some point. And try and thrive in spite of that.
Do you know the poet Khalil Gibran? He wrote a poem about children in which he describes parents as the bow and children are the arrow. So as a parent, you can pull the string of the bow and you can point the arrow. But once you release it, where that arrow lands, obviously, is completely out of your control. And it's a beautiful poem. I would recommend it.
What an amazing analogy. that is a sensation.
And there you go. That's when people say, why doesn't God answer prayers? It's like, have you heard the kind of things your kids ask for? You can't say yes to all of it.
No, you cannot. And I think that individualism, which is the kind of dominant outlook in our society, also inclines to that, because actually, if you come from a philosophy that is much more communal in outlook, your child is part of a wider group, and the responsibilities that you inculcate to that child are not just vis-a-vis you, vis-a-vis him or herself, but towards the wider whole. And in that sense, you know, the idea that they're just out there to do whatever they want to do in life, or, you know, to please you, it's not just either of those. It's like the third dimension to it is, what are they giving back? What are they contributing to wider society? That's a really, really important dimension from my personal point of view.
Very few, if no, parents actually consider, because most people treat their kids as either a 18-year loan on someone else's life or a possession. So, yeah, people don't think about it that way.
Dane, what have you had a chance to think of what you think a good answer to this question is?
Yeah, I do. The thing is, I guess I was fortunate, and it's probably had a large bearing on the way I think as an adult, is because my dad used to just be very upfront with me and tell me most of the stuff I wanted to know when I was a kid, and the stuff I didn't know, because I was very inquisitive, I guess. So as far as the questions, I would ask them a lot of the time as well. The main questions anyway, I think. So I'd always get like through because I guess my parents are having a very nuanced experience compared to a lot of parents, especially even in the UK. So it was kind of, I was always going to have to get like a very straight and very blunt answer, which would have probably removed a lot of disillusionment in my life very early. So,
well, what about emotional intelligence? Because that's one that I feel like as a society. So much of our day to day is engaging with other humans, and yet at no point do we have education about emotions and about connecting with other people, understanding human psychology, understanding that most of the time when people, like you'd said earlier, you know, vomit their emotions onto you, it's not actually about you. Them. It's often about things they're dealing with. And then we perpetuate the cycle and keep throwing that vomit onto other people.
Yeah,
and
that's the one thing I wish someone told me about how heartbreak feels, but how would they describe it? So that's where the one thing I'd want to know would be like what it's like to have a broken heart, because you probably wouldn't be able to articulate that to me when I was an adolescent, because I'd be like, who's breaking my heart, bruv? I'm getting money. But having an experience of having my first loving relationship end.
Did you never listen to R&B?
Yeah, but I listened to it intensely.
I think Boys to Men did a couple of lessons in this.
I listened to it intensely, and obviously it's a very, very cathartic practice to listen to the music that kind of like, you know, articulates that. But it still is. But listening. Yeah. But remember, if I had no frame of reference when I used to listen to R&B, it's like, this is a good song and I like the way they've articulated it, but hearing a song and feeling a song are two very different things. So the way a song would sound before I had my heart broken, the way a song sounds after is two very different things. And so, yeah, so I listen to it all the time, which is probably why it was even more crushing, because I'm like, I'm following the rules in these damn songs, so how could I fuck this up? So I feel like that's one, but I think it's a conversation, that is probably the conversation that people, particularly cishet men, need more than anything else. Is how to mend a broken heart. So I probably say that is probably what I wish I was told when I was younger, because I think most men, like I can tell you for free, the catalyst for most men to develop toxicity in their masculinity begins with heartbreak as the catalyst.
I'm sure that's probably true. Although I have to say that as a woman, I do feel that it's also just swimming in the sea of patriarchy, which is imbibed in every fiber of our society. And so it's very difficult to, one event obviously may, deepen that experience.
When it does happen, because men lack the emotional intelligence and the tools in order to either articulate or to begin repair of that trauma, they tend to identify politically with patriarchy a lot more following that.
Okay, so I hear you on that. And I think this was an interesting conversation I was having recently with someone. I was saying, you know, we women, we basically have constant therapy, right? Every single time you see a girlfriend, you will get the 101 on their state of heart, state of mind, like bare. They will give it to you raw. Every single thing they're going through, every emotion, we will dissect it. We will pick it apart. I'll give my opinion. They'll give their opinion. We'll bounce it back and forth. We'll listen to a few songs, see what that might have to say wisdom wise. And we will put in the effort to pulling those emotions apart and understanding them. I recently had the joy of being around a group of men, all socially distanced, obviously, and observing that there was no conversation.
Well, see, that's ironic for me, because when I was growing up, I would find myself at adversity with men because I was always described as being effeminate and being too loquacious about my feelings, because I was with someone that's like, I don't like that shit. This is how that shit makes me feel. And so normally it'd be like that.
And everyone looked at their phone.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is before phones. So everyone would just be looking, was literally pointing
before
at me.
Phones.
Yeah. I didn't grow up with any other male cousins or brothers. So all of my points and all of the paradigms of discourse I had when I was growing up were with women. So it was always seems natural.
But I think it served you. I think it served you so well.
Well, this is why now I'm not getting towards my 40s and about to be on the cusp of a nervous breakdown, because I've been able to talk about and rationalize and articulate my feelings, or at least knowing if I am dealing with any issue of toxicity or aggression, I understand where that stems from. So,
And also I can testify that countless female participants of this podcast or in the comedy industry have so much love for Mr. Dane Baptiste. And that will be partly what you, your upbringing what you were just describing.
Well, and also a broken heart, man. And I say that, and the reason why, like I said, that's so important to learn is because it's a very egalitarian experience. And so, for example, I couldn't be where, you know, some of my peers where I grew up may have their misgivings about, like, you know, homosexual relationships or gay marriage, for example. Me, I'm like, listen, if you know what it's like to have your heart broken and to feel alone and to feel like you've lost love, you wouldn't stand in the way of that for anybody.
That is one of the such a great, I think we could do the whole episode just about that question, couldn't we, Dane? It's wonderful. Thank you for bringing that to us.
My pleasure. I will continue to seek answers, but thank you for your contribution.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Yeah, it's kind of quite an uplifting question in some ways, actually, because it's so self-reflective. And I'm potentially about to do not that. The listeners would have heard in your introduction, you know, you have looked at some very major issues in your, you know, documentary work around Muslim marriage, Syrian refugees, and obviously your podcast looks at kind of whiteness. And I mean, look, you are politically savvy, aware human being, and I thought this was an opportunity to talk about one subject that I know causes great controversy, and this podcast can be useful to kind of offer some kind of nuanced conversation about immigration. And my question is, you know, what is the best approach moving forward in a post-COVID world to what has been termed the immigration crisis? And you can obviously say to me, maybe to you, that you don't think it is a crisis, but obviously in many people's eyes it is. And I'd love to hear where your kind of your opinion lies on that, Dr. Miriam.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, you might have heard that in the wake of the pandemic, the UK population has shrunk by 1.3 million. It's an unprecedented exodus of foreign workers. It's the largest fall in the UK population since the Second World War. So the subject of immigration is about to come back on the agenda in a big way. And obviously, post-Brexit, we are talking about a different form of immigration, because up until this point, we had free movement of people, which meant I could go back to my countries of origin freely, and you could go to Spain for your holiday to Ibiza without having to have a visa. Now, obviously, we're looking at a very different situation, the rules for coming to the UK are going to be very different. And I suspect that the makeup of immigration is going to look quite different. And the immigration debate has so there are two components I think are probably worth taking into consideration. One is the argument of people like my brother, who works in construction, who, you know, is probably part of a much wider group, who will say, look, we work in an industry where wages are forced down by immigrant labourers, who will accept terms much lower than the ones that we would accept, and therefore we're then being driven out of jobs, right? And that's a reality. And I think it's something that we have to listen to. You know, it's what drove my youngest brother to vote Brexit. it's closer to home than you
think. I know, as well. I've done gigs where half of them are like, we voted to leave. And I'm like, you're all Nigerians, but all right.
Yeah, and so we know places like Luton, right, voted majority Brexit, when, you know, you wouldn't necessarily expect an area which is itself indebted to immigration to vote against Brexit. But so I think there's one side of the story that does need to be listened to. And otherwise, we end up where the US is today, with a society that's so deeply polarized that no one can understand the other. Like, it's literally like there is a divide so deep that, you know, the dehumanization is
that point is so important to me in this conversation, because the listeners and everyone, I'm aware that this is a difficult thing to take, but people like Nigel Farage and Donald Trump, who have used their immigration to gain power, have done so in a callous and entirely dishonorable way. But the conversation that there is a conversation that people can have about immigration that doesn't need to be on
racist.
Those terms.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, on those terms where you're kind of trying to make people into the enemy. It's particularly the American one, which is, you can look at South America,
yes,
and categorically understand many, many decades of foreign policy, not just America, but predominantly America, have led to humanitarian problems that have led to people wanting to flee those countries. And there's always that thing that it's awkward, to say this, but like, I'm a Jew, so it's kind of easier in some ways. But like, some people say, go back to your own country thing. And I'm like, sometimes I hear that. And I think a lot of people would quite like that if that country was how they wanted it to be. Mm. This country's really cold.
Yeah.
Britain is really cold. I don't think everyone really wants to be here all the time. But obviously some of what this country offers is just intangibly, powerful to people's lives.
100%. And there's a lot here that people, having had the privilege of traveling for work to, all corners of the world and seeing, it's a bit like how I feel about the vaccine conversation. I've traveled to places where people would beg you for vaccines that we get for free so that their children don't die. We take for granted so many things. And in fact, for me, Brexit in many ways was a vote of the ungrateful. For me, it's the ultimate haughtiness of a society that believes that things can never get worse. And that is only true of people who don't know how bad life can actually get. And
incredible sentence.
It's a fact. I'm sorry to say it, because I wish that I could show people how bad it can get, and that so much of what we have fought for in this country and acquired through unlawful means as well are things that now people just think are going to be there forever. And I think that we are now seeing a rollback on so many things. I mean, today poverty being one of them. We now know with COVID almost 700,000 people driven into poverty, 120,000 children. It's almost 23% of the population in the UK now living in poverty. Unless you've lived in poverty, you cannot possibly enter the conversation on this debate, in my opinion. Only people who know poverty, only people who haven't had enough food in their cupboards, who haven't been able to feed their kids, who've had to choose between heating and lighting, are allowed to speak on this one. Because if you haven't, you're making a gamble on things that you take for granted every day. And that's not okay. You're not allowed to make that decision about other people's lives. You're not allowed to say, I can have these things and it's normal, and other people have to choose between heating and food. It's, in my opinion, grotesque. Well,
it's so important to talk about it in this kind of way. I mean, Dane, I was talking to someone the other day who said to me that they think the people in history will look back on this time and suggest that immigration was the biggest issue we faced.
I quite frankly am fucking tired of hearing people talk about immigration. From a semantic perspective, there is no conversation to be had by anybody in the West about fucking immigration. Because even if you do articulate your worst fears about immigration, how are those different to any form of colonialism that you have displayed, which allowed you to acquire all of the resource wealth that you have in the first place? So if people are worried about immigration, don't go to their fucking countries in the first place. And then you won't create this vacuum of the resource deficiency and brain drains in the form of acquiring labor. Because while everyone is remaining subservient to the system of capitalism, you're going to have immigration. Because if you are going to create a system of global capitalism, which we have done since the 90s, Therefore, if money is now able to freely cross borders and exchange in currency markets, you're going to have the same thing with labor markets, because that's what capitalism is. It's the exploitation of labor and resources for capital gain. So if you want to continue this exploitation, you're going to have to be able to facilitate that through the movement of people. So at some point, these two worlds are going to meet, whereby your labor needs to be able to move in order for you to realize economic growth, because that's how we even measure economic growth. Within our current capitalist system, without immigration, your economy is not able to grow. So there is no conversation to be had about immigration whatsoever, because the inconvenient truth for all people who express their misgivings about immigration is, if everybody was supposed to live in their indigenous countries, which they're indigenous to, and to subsist of their indigenous resources, the West would just collapse. That's the end of it.
100%.
There's no conversation to be fucking had. If England had to subsist on its own resources, it would collapse. Even now, as Brexit begins to take firm hold and people are talking about fishing and they were lied to, you don't even have the industrial competence to provide a fishing industry anyway. Even if you got your fishing back, there's not enough people with competitive competence to do it. There's no conversation for all of this stuff. And really, this is, for me, it's just a part of a larger conversation just about global capitalist white supremacy anyway. Because in the same way that if you were enjoying free trade and a free market, then you wouldn't have excise and tariff duties and other systems of protectionism that allow for the West to remain economically competitive with more resource-rich nations. That, again, itself is about loading the dice in your favor. There is no conversation to be had. Even if you are having the conversation about the availability of work within the West, with the rise of automation and the ability to outsource labor and, again, continue to exploit it outside of the borders of your own country, your brother is not going to have a fucking job in 5 years anyway. When people talk about this, again, we are all also beginning to drift into this idea that capitalism is a function of you get out what you put in. That is also not how it works, because one of the boons of people is a complete myth, because one of the boons of enjoying immigrant labor or enjoying foreign labor or outsourcing labor is you are not beholden to collective bargaining. Whereas most English people who are saying stuff like we want our rights back, by you even saying that, you already don't have an idea about how the rest of the global workforce works. Because if you go anywhere else in Asia, for example, and talk about, I want an hour break, you're going to get punched in the face.
Well, yeah, or like we saw with the iPhone factories in China, right, where instead of listening to complaints from workers that they were overworked, the company simply put up netting outside the windows to prevent suicide. So you could still jump, but you wouldn't die.
So then not only that, you can't escape. And even if you look at the presence of tech and how tech is now manifesting physically within the working world, if you go to Google or these places, they have a creche, they have a restaurant, they have sleeping quarters. You are not leaving the premises. So in order for you to become competitive, your employment or your basic industrial identity is going to change significantly. It's not going to be enough for you to just go to a building site, do your work and go home. You stay there. Because now multinationals have replaced nations in terms of the amount of financing and the ability they have in order to remunerate their citizens, and more than any government can now. So if you go and work for a private company as an employee, now because you are no longer protected by EU labor laws, you stay in where the fuck you're working. You don't leave the building site until it's fixed.
You know, you touched on kind of the pyramid shape of capitalism, which is essentially a small elite. I mean, we're sold the myth of meritocracy. We're even sold it from some of the figures of the American dream, you know. And that the problem with that, of course, is that it relies on today a global underclass being exploited. We have because they have not. And when they come knocking on our doors saying, guys, we can see what you guys have got. We'd like some. Plus, you keep talking about universal human rights. So are we not universal? Are we not human? Do we not get in on this? And the answer is no. The answer is no, because if you want to maintain the standards that you have now, then you're not going to be able to do that by expanding that wealth to the whole globe. That's just not going to happen. So we do have to have a conversation around what it is that you really want. And I feel like this is where the conversation then ends up with, you know, well, it's either kind of, you know, no borders, redistribution to everyone, you know, let's go back to living much simpler lives, which, you know, ultimately we may...
Tricky things for the average person to get
their
head around.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know why the average person can't plant food anyway. So what fuck do they care? They're not doing anything anyway. Most of their life is going to be subsisted by technology as it is. So we've already had a massive regression whereby, listen, you two are talking about how can people go back? We have the internet yet and people are tweeting that the earth is flat, even though a satellite is required for them to convey this message to the world, they're saying that the earth is flat. So they've not got that far for them to have to go back. That's how I see it. So there's no conversation about the issue of immigration. Immigration still being an issue. All it is that the term immigrant has now been used as the former umbrella term for the N-word and the P-word. That is what immigrant... Because no one cares about immigrants from former Yugoslavia. No one really cares about immigrants from South Africa that are returning to repatriate the UK after being kicked out.
They care about the Poles, though, because my brother's girlfriend is Polish, and the Poles have got their fair share of abuse. I also know some Romanian friends who would say that the Romanians who would be perceived, so whiteness obviously is down to perception, right?
Yeah.
But there's obviously a gradient of whiteness. Like, some people are considered white. I would call, like, Jacob Rees-Mogg would be white.
Well, yeah, whiteness is very easy to identify because it exists as a hierarchy. And at the top of the hierarchy would be white Anglo-Saxon Protestants.
Yes.
Below them would be white Catholics, like the Irish or the Italians. And then below them, potentially, you would have, Europeans.
Where the Jews. The Jews need to get in here.
Well, it's not third, Howard.
It's not third.
We're not third.
Because you're also... Because
we've probably gone up the ladder a bit.
If you want to look at the hierarchy the last century. Where Jews are, you just need to look at Sacha Baron Cohen's work and all the people he makes fun of, the Jews will be under them. And even then, really, we're talking about Ashkenazi Jews who would be based in Europe, where Sephardic Jews who maybe have more Mediterranean or Middle Eastern
will have a different experience,
as would Mithrazi Jews. Yeah. So it's more about you being a Jew of Eastern European origin, Howard, because by the same token, Romanians being from Indochina or Indo-European origin can look very dark, as dark as someone who is black, but also can be very pale. So even being Romanian.
I mean, that's the most enthralling version of kind of tackling immigration I've heard for a long time, Dane. And we're gonna pass it over to Dane for the final question of today's show that has been one of the most brilliant, deep, divey ones we've had for a while.
Sweet. Dane?
Absolutely. And I was in no way surprised. This has always been preempted for a previous podcast with Dr. Francois. That being said, Doctor, obviously... being somewhat of a medical professional with a doctorate and several accommodations, including masters, but also being very outspoken and being representative of your faith. I imagine, and I'm sure you'll be able to clear this up in your answer, that there must be some kind of duality in terms of studying fields of life sciences and the mind, as well as, trying to always improve your connection with your own spirituality and with the Creator. So my question was, given the state of the world now, where do you think healing or solutions will come from a scientific or from a divine source?
Ooh, interesting one. I think that the binary of science versus religion is a very Eurocentric debate. I think that if you look at Islamic history, we have not had that kind of a conflict. The Quran does not claim to be a scientific manual. I would disagree with any Muslim who tries to use it to those ends. And historically, it hasn't really been used to those ends. If you look at the Islamic empires throughout history, there's been periods of kind of thriving, scientific thriving, which have never really been at odds with religious authority, particularly because the spirit of inquisition from an Islamic perspective is kind of a dialectic between the exploration of the natural world and a return to textuality, which can continuously be reread in different ways. So there is no immutable meaning to the text. There is an immutable text, but a text that can be reread throughout history at different times with different bits of information that we can access that allows us to deepen our understanding of the world and through that of God. Hashtag him herself. And so in terms of what I'm looking for in the, what I'm looking at this particular moment in time, look, I think that we are holistic beings. We are beings that are mind, body, soul, and we cannot discount any one aspect without it having a detrimental impact on the whole. And I do think that as individuals, when we lose touch of our spiritual nature, we lose a groundedness and a connection with the self. I think some people would call it the self. I would call it with God. That conversation with the self, the conversation with the self about what you stand for, who you aspire to be, what You know, some people would talk about it in terms of like the legacy you leave behind. As a spiritual person, I look at it as the actions I put forward and which I'm accountable for in the future. So at an individual level, I feel like it's really important to have spirituality in order to be a centered and grounded person and to retain a sense of humility of your place within the world. But as a society, I've never thought it's more urgent for us to reconnect with the divine. And I say that because I think we are a society which is now no longer guided at all by ideology. Ideology is considered actually to be a bad word. We are guided purely by capitalism, by actually the kind of final stages of really quite raw capitalism. And when we do that, we lose sight of the human values, of the transcendental values that are, I think, that stand on a higher rank than, you know, the accumulation of wealth. And so that's where we get profit before people. And so I do think that when you reconnect with the divine, and you can call it whatever you like, I don't really have a monopoly on whatever you want to call that, but you are reconnecting with what is really, truly important to us as humans. And when we don't, we leave that conversation to the economy.
Amazing. What an amazing
answer. I'll stop talking
answer.
Now because I feel like that was quite a long answer, but yeah.
No answer is too short or inappropriate either. So, I mean, that's perfect. I mean, yeah, because I was just trying to work it out because, and you kind of covered it, is whereby, like you said, we have now kind of turned our back on and tend to reject ideology, even though that's normally the basis for whole human existence and advancement. But yeah, I just think it's been a long sustained campaign from the powers that be to emphasize capitalism. So, you know, people don't tend to act or even think about how to act or innovate without it be providing some kind of financial or fiscal reward,
yeah,
which is just an insane way to move because it's a fucking religion itself.
Yes, it is. And it's and sadly, it also means that we have then a degradation in the value we attribute to people who are extremely good and diligent at doing jobs that are not profitable. And because they are not profitable jobs, they're jobs that are then looked down on. And I'm much more inclined to look at, you know, particularly in Eastern philosophy, the idea that whatever job it is that you're doing, and we have this principle in Islam as well, like whatever job that you're doing it, you should always do it. You know, we say fi sabilillah, for the sake of God. And when we do it for the sake of God, we do it with excellence in mind. Whatever it is that you're doing, you could be sweeping a street, you could be running a huge company, whatever it is, you have to be doing it with excellence in mind. But if we only attribute value to those jobs that have large monetary payouts, then we degrade the input of people who are doing really important jobs, but that are not well paid. And that includes mothering, actually. And I would point to a degradation of motherhood as a role as linked to the lack of monetary value associated with, and actually the monetary loss associated with becoming a mother.
I mean, and that is the level of how far we have sunk as a society, as if we're kind of like, yeah, but all they do is make sure that we survive. Mm, what?
Yeah.
That's where we are, a society where it's like, why are we going to pay women to when they're having babies? That's how you fucking get here.
Yes.
To Earth.
Yes.
You fucking idiots.
Yes. Yes.
That's how you get here. If your mother is not doing well, you won't get here very well.
Yes.
How can you go to a private school and not understand that fucking concept?
Yeah.
It's called Mother Earth for a reason, right?
And indeed.
Mother Nature. But I mean, it's interesting the thing you said about jobs.
If your Christian God didn't need women, why the fuck did he involve Mary anyway? He could have just stood it through Joseph's bum, priest, then. Couldn't he? Because it's God. He can do anything. So why he would have chosen Immaculate Conception, he obviously recognises the importance of women's role, even in giving birth to his own fucking son.
The point you made about work really resonates with me, Miriam, because I have, for the past year, been kind of leading a very, you know, small production company, or, you know, kind of trying to build projects for TV and digital platforms and doing our thing and kind of, you know, had not had to answer to as many people as I have in the past. And actually reminded me about, you know, early stages of my career where I people in outside of the television industry know that the first job you do is a runner. You're called a runner, and yes, you basically make the tea and pick up parcels and all that stuff.
And also, and spurn the sexual advances of creepy talent.
Yes.
Not for me.
But I'm sure someone did. I'm sure somebody would have solicited you at least.
I can't remember anyone. But I remember doing that job and actually being quite good at it. Like I was kind of, you know, because I can talk to people, right? So like part of the problem with some people doing that job at their early stages of their career or professional lives is they feel very nervous and kind of worried about talking to people, and that actually makes it the whole process of that job a bit awkward, where I just talk to anyone. So I just, you know, kind of chat with whoever, and you know, usually it meant that it helped me. I mean, it actually helped me develop my career, really, because the person who was in charge was like, oh yeah, he's all right, because he, you know, he can talk to us, and also not fuck up my tea.
And
those kind of things, when I look back on it now, I kind of think, actually, you know, I've never ever stopped being incredibly kind, deliberately most of the time, to the person in those positions, because I know that they obviously don't want to do that for the rest of their life. And in television, that's a very clear progression. Now, that's not to say that everyone ends up doing my job. They might end up being a cameraman, right, an editor. They might work in, you know, the management of the productions. They do all manner of jobs, right? But the nature of it is that when you start in that career, you're not there to do that job at the start, right? The rest, you're not here for 20 years to be a runner, right? In every other industry, in a lot of other industries, that isn't the case. You're not going to have a natural progression, but people want it. And it's not healthy always, right? Because it's not going to be there for everyone. Not everyone's going to go from the first step on the ladder to the top of it. And by the idea that somehow that is the only point of what we do.
But here's where the paradox is that in order for that person to validate their position or elevate a position of power, they can't do that unless we recognize it. So this is almost one of the semantic privileges of being a black person, is that you see firsthand that you can be awarded a title or status or prestige, but it doesn't mean people have to respect it, because I can be making more than any policeman anywhere, but he'll always take a position of superiority just because of the function of white supremacy, irrespective of who I am, even if I'm a member of parliament or for that, just based on appearance, I'm going to be treated a particular way. And then also the thing is, I would say this is because you know, you say you treat everyone the same, because everyone is exactly the same. Because if someone professes or postulates about their position and says, I'm the manager, and we go, so, then their power is diminished. So it's a weird thing where it's like, yeah, people will try and abuse their power, but it's like this power, the power of your abuse or your abuse of your power or to lord over me only comes from the fact that I recognize that power.
Well, and I also think that there's that thing, and listen, I bet you both can tell me you've seen this in telly or media, that there's that person who treats the person that's the runner or the tea maker like shit, probably never had to do it.
Or they probably did have to do it, and they were so crushed and it's about making the decision if they are going to be a victim of their experiences or a product of them. So what people tend to do is, maybe, because a lot of the time, so they say hurt people.
Right.
A lot of people that are...
Perpetuation of trauma.
So a lot of time, Howard, it's people that have themselves been bullied throughout their life, and then they try to rationalize it by recreating the same paradigm, but this time, now that they have the position of control over the trauma, then it's fine. In the same way that sometimes women who are victims of sexual trauma enjoy sex to be slightly rougher, because it's like, well, now, if I recreate the paradigm and I'm in control of it, then it's no longer traumatic. And it's almost like you're revisiting the same situation, but this time, it's like having a lucid dream, but this time I'm in control of what's happening. Or in that paradigm, I now have the position of power of oppressor. Problem with that being is that by you doing that is that you are validating the actions of your oppressor, or you are validating your trauma, because you're like, now, if you was in a position of power, you would do the same thing.
And this is where, I guess, to loop it back to the question around, spirituality, is that the accountability, the self-accountability that faith imposes on you. And I'm not saying that every person of faith is, you know, more accountable than the next person that isn't of faith, because there are plenty of people who don't have faith who are quite demanding of themselves in terms of accountability. But it is a precept within our religions to hold yourself accountable for your actions, regardless of how other people have treated you. And there are so many stories in our faith about somebody haughty and wealthy and powerful treating somebody poor in a bad way, and actually that person turning out to be an angel or a messenger of God, or, you know, somebody of a much higher spiritual status than themselves. And so I suppose I am so grateful that there is that within our faith, that that whoever it is that you're speaking to, you actually have no idea what their position is in the eyes of God. It may be,
and it shouldn't matter. And it you shouldn't even, like I said, you shouldn't even have to rely on any external system of hierarchy for you to determine how you treat a human
100%,
being.
100%, because you recognize their innate humanity, which was God bestowed, and no one can remove that. That is something that you.
And that's why people are scared of Islam, because they think it's actual socialism, because everyone's the same in the eyes of God. That's what scares them.
It is radical in that sense. And in, it also calls for something which I feel is missing in our society that I speak a lot about, which is radical empathy, which is the idea that whoever that you're in front of, however much you disagree and dislike that person, the minute you fail to acknowledge their full humanity, you are in effect degrading your own humanity. And if we just held to that principle, anytime you encountered somebody who was, you know, what we call triggering in our current parlance in these affairs, you would recognize that there is something in that conversation which is blocking you from seeing the person in front of you. And if you could identify what that thing was, it would actually teach you more about yourself than about that person and about the work you have to do on yourself. But instead, we just, as you say, perpetuate.
It's a tough ask of a lot of people. It's much easier to throw stones than try and ascend the throne.
Yeah, but so, that's what I think that was partly where my first question, if you recall, about what do you wish others had taught you? It was, you know, I really wish that we'd been taught that, you know, and I try and teach this to my son every time, you know, he'll say, oh, this kid did this, said this thing that really upset me. And I usually say, you know, it's probably something that he's going through and he's just vomiting his pain on you. So you don't have to take that on board, you know.
Or his parents are shit, man. And if they tell me their names, we'll go to their doorstep tonight.
But
maybe that's why I'm not really.
What an absolutely brilliant, I hope our listeners have enjoyed that as much as I have, because I think that's such a great deep dive into so many things, right, Dane? It's been a real joy today.
With absolutely no surprise, I am very happy for this meeting of minds, Dr.
Thank
Francois.
You, my pleasure.
And it did not disappoint at all. And however, for the listeners, sure you're not aware, the doctor was obviously super prepared with four questions. So we would definitely like to have you back for a part two.
Gladly.
I feel like 2021, Howard, is going to be about a lot of part twos, because we've had such interesting guests so early on in the year that...
I'm well up for it. Well, I mean, also, we're probably going to have to make this. Hopefully, we'll keep making this podcast for the rest of our lives, then, so we definitely have time.
I hope that for both of you.
True, because you never know, Howard. There's going to be, you know, your great grandkids might be like, who was Grandpa Howard? And now they'll be able to find out, because they'll hear the.
Oh, podcast. I think about that a lot. Our kids going back over our digital footprints. That's always an interesting one.
Well, thank you so much for coming on our show. It's been an absolute joy.
And, Doctor, since we are still on lockdown, and while comedy is the best medicine, is not the required vaccination. In the meantime, where can our listeners find out more of your great works, or check out some of your great works that already
exist? Can check out my website. So it's www.miriamfrancois, Miriam with a Y, M-Y-R-A-A-M, and then Francois, F-R-A-N-C-O-I-S.com. And if you want to check out my podcast, it's called We Need to Talk About Whiteness, and you can find me on Spotify and iTunes and on SoundCloud, and also the website by the same name, weneedtotalkaboutwhiteness.com.
Thank you. Well, it's been a real joy, and we'll look forward to getting you back again
soon.
Thank you. And
it's been wonderful. And again, please do let us know when you'll be available for a part two. I wish we could go on but for more, but lots of podcasts to do, a lot of information to disseminate, and a lot of work for the doctors to do. And we'd be remiss for us to hold you from doing your good work, Doctor. So thank you so much. And the biggest salam alaikum, akum master.
Wa alaikum assalam.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeast. Our guest was Dr. Miriam Francois. You can follow Dr. Miriam on Twitter at MiriamFrancoisC or on Instagram at MyZFrancois. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheHowardCohen.
The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at We Are Audio Culture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQE Podcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.